This is Barbara Glickstein with HealthCetera. Joining me today is Liz Siegert, HealthCetera's correspondent on aging. And these are her words from a recent talk she did on ageism. Quote, "What's more, ageism is the only form of prejudice we will all experience if we live long enough. So I want to talk about the impact of ageism on health, on culture, and on our values, as well as how to spot it and how to counter it. Well, I'm looking forward to this conversation. I recently turned 69 years of age, and I have been doing a lot of reflection myself on what does it mean to be approaching 70? How do I feel about aging? What feels differently to me, if anything? And also, how do I resist what the culture seems to impose on me as a feminist, as someone who does not want to support ageism and believes that my vitality and what I can still contribute is as important as it's ever been? Welcome back to HealthCetera, Liz.
Hey, Barbara. Good to be here.
So we have this, you know, gendered ageism and cultural ageism and ageism of every type. Certainly, I will say as a woman, I think there is more pressure on us. I'll ask you if you agree with that or your data supports that. And let's talk about ageism. Where do you want to start?
Oh, there's so many things we could talk about when it comes to ageism. I think that your point about women being subjected to it more often is almost absolutely on the mark. If you look at just some of the advertisements that are on television, there are all these anti-aging creams and lotions and makeup tricks. And any, you know, Instagram reel can show you how to look younger in 2 minutes or less in the morning. I noticed it, especially during the pandemic, because I decided I would let my hair go gray, or as one of my friends put it, go natural, which is really what it is. And since that time, I've noticed a definite shift, not in everybody, but in many people, in their attitude, how they approach me, even saying things like yes, ma'am, and no, ma'am. And I keep looking over my shoulder, wondering who they're talking to.
I hear you. I find that when I'm walking in the busy, crowded neighborhood I live in New York City, that I can feel as though I'm invisible. And it's expected that I would move over or slow down to let people pass me, which ain't happening as far as I'm concerned, unless it's for someone who is in need of having the lane that I might be in that space, whether it's a mom with a baby stroller or someone else who needs the space more than me. But I'm not moving over for a younger person who's wants to go, he or she can go around me. But what is ageism? Let's give everyone the working definition, which I know you, in your research, Dr. Butler, who was very much the champion of ageism and coined the phrase. So what is ageism?
Well, it's interesting that Robert Butler coined this phrase back in 1969, when the other catchphrase was, don't trust anyone over 30. And that in itself is a form of ageism, feeling like older people can't be trusted, or they are not in the same mindset that younger people are. And that's couldn't be further from the truth the majority of the time. Ageism is really stereotypes and discrimination, avoidance, dislike, and really looking down your nose at people simply because of their age. It's pervasive in healthcare. It's pervasive in housing, and it's definitely pervasive in employment opportunities as well as services. And as you say, even walking down the street, feeling like, why is this older person taking up space when it's rush hour and they're in my way?
Yeah. You cited some very interesting demographics about where we are in the United States with the demographics of people older than 65 and projections. You want to share some of that with us? I was actually struck by the numbers.
Well, I think, you know, one of the key demographics is that for the first time in history, there will be more people in the world over age 64 than under age 5.
Wow.
And in just a few years, by 2030, 1 in 5 Americans will be 65 or older, and you and I will both be in that category. So the number of baby boomers, the number of people born just before the baby boom is growing exponentially. And Gen Xers soon will start aging into that 65 plus category as well, the early Gen Xers. So as a society, we're growing by leaps and bounds in terms of the older demographic. And the more older people there are, hopefully the more attention we can draw in a positive way rather than in a negative way.
So this is good news. And also we've recently seen that in the United States, people are dying younger and are the mortality rates are dropping, particularly in the Black community and people of color. So it's an interesting comparison of a growing aging population because of science and healthier living, adaptation to lifestyle changes as that have been supportive of aging. So how do we understand this? How do we see this as both happening at the same time?
Well, I think you hit it on the head. Medical science has allowed us to live longer with chronic conditions like diabetes or heart disease. At the same time, there's issues of health inequity, access, prevalence of disease among certain populations, some of which has to do with culture, diet, lifestyle, those sorts of things. A lot of it does have to do with access to care. But one of the things I learned in my research is that about 93% of people over 50 experience some sort of ageism in their daily lives. And wow. About 1 out of every $7 is spent on the most 8 expensive healthcare conditions among people 60 and older. And that spending is directly or indirectly linked to ageism. The reason that's important is because quite often as we get older, I think physicians tend not to listen to their patients perhaps as closely as they should. You know, a lot of times, and I've experienced this, I've seen it with when I took my dad to the doctor several years ago, you go in with a complaint and the response is, well, what do you expect at your age? Of course, you might be having some memory issues, or of course, your joints might be hurting. It's age, but not everything is age-related. And sometimes significant health issues can be overlooked or dismissed because doctors aren't trained to necessarily recognize some of the subtle changes that come with getting older.
What are the kinds of things that people hear in those encounters in healthcare from a provider that are examples of ageist approach to medical care and an assumption that this is not necessarily a health problem? You're 72, we expect this. What kinds of things do people hear, Liz?
Well, a part of the problem is that, you know, doctors may write a prescription not fully believing the person's complaint. For example, suppose they're complaining of joint pain or stiffness, and they may chalk it up to, oh, you know, it's just age-related arthritis or you're slowing down or whatever. But they may not fully investigate if there's an underlying problem. Perhaps there's, you know, some kind of lingering infection that, you know, something as simple as a UTI. urinary tract infection could be causing, you know, symptoms that a doctor might dismiss. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times doctors get dismissive and they tend to undertreat. The other side of the coin is some doctors, because they're possibly afraid of being accused of undertreating, will overtreat. So they'll write a prescription for everything. And as we know, older adults are also subject to polypharmacy. They take multiple prescriptions often as it is. And when you start mixing too many prescriptions, you can get some strange side effects. And again, rather than looking at perhaps the prescription list, they'll just write another prescription to cope with the side effect. So if one prescription maybe makes you feel a little lightheaded or dizzy, then they'll give you something else to handle that, rather than say, hey, maybe we need to change up the meds you're already on before we give you yet another medication.
It speaks to the role of both your primary care provider or your gerontologist, your nurse practitioner, your primary care physician, that you have a relationship with a pharmacist if you can, so that they're also tracking the amounts of medications and have a better eye to what might be this polypharmacy problem, and that some of this be an indication of a side effect of one other medication. Some listeners may not know that many pharmacists will sit with you, or you can schedule an appointment to review your medications. So I encourage both my parents to do that when they were still alive. And there was some very fruitful conversation about whether or not they still needed to be on one of the medications, which they then brought that information back to their physician and it was evaluated. And so these are I think it's helpful to also talk about, what do you do in a situation like that? What do you recommend someone say to a care provider that is just writing a script right away that might slow that down and change the direction of it? Is there some advice you'd like to provide?
I think you have to go in and be your own advocate and forcefully, but politely, say to your provider, I really need you to listen to me. I need you to look up from your computer. I need you to look up from the notes you are writing. Here's what is going on, and here's what I think is happening. What do you think? Hmm. And if they are dismissive, quite frankly, I would find another provider.
Yeah, not always easy, but certainly a good piece of advice. You mentioned a couple of moments ago about the anti-aging culture and product. I was struck by the numbers there as well. You reported that in 2018, more than $60 billion in excess healthcare costs, which was the medical ageism. And then, of course, the billions of dollars on anti-aging products, many of them not proven to be effective, impactful, researched, or whatever. So those who are listening who are reaching for those containers with the term anti-aging, is there anything to back that up on most of these products, Liz?
Most of these products, the ones for memory, the ones for giving you a youthful glow, even the anti-aging creams and lotions, are not necessarily backed by independent science. The manufacturers themselves may have run some small trials, but unless it's independently backed, I would be skeptical. I also want to point out that none of these products are regulated by the FDA at this point, although there is some noise about possibly the FDA getting involved in some nutritional supplements, so that pretty much anybody can put out almost any claim and call it an anti-aging product. What's troubling too is, why do we need anti-aging? When you think about it, aging into your 70s or 80s is a terrific scientific achievement. A century ago, the average lifespan was 45, 48 years old. So we've pretty much doubled that, or come close to it, particularly for women who tend to outlive men. And that's an amazing scientific accomplishment. This is something we should be celebrating, not fearing. There are so many people that are productive well into their 70s, 80s, 90s, even 100. Look at somebody like Norman Lear, who is still at 100 years old producing television shows.
And good ones.
And good ones. I recently heard a podcast featuring Mel Brooks, who I believe is now 97 or 98, and he is just as funny as he's always been. There are people like Jane Goodall, the environmental activist, who was just celebrated at her 89th birthday. And she's still involved in things like saving the planet. It's pretty important stuff,
I'll say. And our own president, who is 80, has certainly, we see enough of that ageism being expressed by some of the GOP candidates about why he shouldn't run again, as well as some of the media coverage, which has been quite ageist from my seat, wondering and questioning, although we know that he's constantly being evaluated and all the medical reports that are reported have him in good shape. So I think there's, we're seeing it in the media, in even in terms of our own president. I do want to talk about how in different cultures and ethnicities that, there is more respect towards the elder as one of a person of wisdom. And certainly it's not all Americans or all peoples who feel this way. And some of that, as you have stated, in your writing, can be addressed by having more intergenerational encounters. And you and I both share that experience, right, Liz? We're very engaged and involved in our adult children and the grandchildren. And it's exhausting, but it's keeping us young, isn't it?
It's keeping us young, yes. Like, and exhausting would be an understatement at times. That's the nature of toddlers. At the same time, it's a wonderful experience and it's a bonding experience that I wouldn't trade for the extra hours of sleep I've given up over the past several years.
I totally agree. I think that in families and in communities, whether you're involved in a place of worship and or a community center that is engaging intergenerational encounters, doing fun things together, taking walks together, going to the playgrounds, whatever it is, I think it allows for some of this myth and stigmatizing to be hard pressed to be recognized when taking a ball out and running around, maybe a little bit slower than the 6-year-old or the 12-year-old, but certainly engaging in a playful way, as well as having conversations, is very beneficial. And I think some cultures in society already recognize the benefit of that. And there's a deep sense of both respect and revere of the elder. Has that been your experience?
There definitely is a cultural difference. If you look at Asian cultures, for example, or certainly in many of the Black families, often they refuse to put their older parent or grandparent into a long-term care facility. It's expected that that person will live at home with one of their adult children or grandchildren. And they are venerated as the keeper of the family history, the keeper of wisdom. And it's just expected. We live in a culture now where families are often very scattered and they don't necessarily have that intergenerational support as they perhaps did decades ago. I can remember as a very, very young child, my great-grandfather came to live with my grandparents until my grandmother could no longer care for her father, and eventually did have to put him in a nursing home. He just got too sick, but it was not unexpected. Her mother had lived with them for a while, and my grandfather's parents had also lived with them for a while because that's just what people did back then. It's something that if we start educating children about at a very young age, toddler age, the age of our grandkids, Perhaps we can start busting some of those stereotypes, because if you look at TV shows, if you look at even some of the cartoons that they watch, older people are stereotyped into frumpy, they're geezers, they're grumpy old men, you name it. And that's what kids grow up with. So it's ingrained. It probably was ingrained in us growing up as well. And it's only changing now because we're on the other side of the coin here.
Thank you, Liz Siegert, Health Cetera's correspondent on aging. We're certainly together fighting it, as well as I'm sure many of our listeners. You've given us some great tips on how to approach this. And I say we're all in this together, and we're a powerful group. We still vote, and we make our choices on how we spend our money. So make sure you're thinking about that the next time you look at that anti-aging product. Thanks for joining me today.
My pleasure, Barbara. Anytime.